Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's August 28th, 2022, and welcome to episode 259 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, preparation, COBOL transistors, all sorts of things. I am Paul Hagstrom near Boston. I am joined by two retro computing enthusiasts today. Quinn Dunkey, somewhere north of the border.
Hello. Yes, we'll go with the wilderness of British Columbia. That's my official location.
Okay. How are you?
I'm excellent. It's actually a beautiful day here. It's finally, the heat finally broke. We've been having a crazy heat wave here, so it's nice to have a temperate day for once.
Yeah, actually, that seems like it happened here as well. It just sort of all of a sudden was not hot. Okay. Also joining us is Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
All of a sudden, I'm also not hot. Happens in high school.
Sudden is a strong word for what happened there.
Sudden. I'm doing great. Weather here is good. It was Fan Expo in Toronto.
I was going to ask if you went.
800 yeah. million billion people. No. So many people. But I did accompany, I don't know how much I'm allowed to talk about it, but I got to play with telepresence robot stuff. So going around Fan Expo was a silicone version of me. Didn't have my face on it, which is hugely disappointing. But I got to like pilot a little robot thing around and stuff and didn't send it down any escalators or anything. So huge success.
That's really quite cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. So I've been spending a lot of time looking at a TV and getting to move things around and stuff, and it's cool. It failed. So much failure. It was not ready for prime time, but it was cool to play with.
So. Was that Arrested Development or whatever, where the like the telepresence robots got into a fight?
Right.
But you didn't tell us the ending where the robot got COVID and died and then it was all...
Yes, almost certainly every I got to see, no one had masks. I just looked through my monitor and went, I'm glad I'm here, because wow, 150,000 people there and maybe five
I thought
masks.
They were requiring them.
It's great. Crazy. Not at this event, apparently.
Wow, okay.
And you think, like, everyone could have just been in costume. There's lots of opportunities for masks at a fan club.
Yeah, well, that's last year they had a small event, and they required masks and vaccinations, and so everybody just came as characters who were wearing masks. It worked out great.
But the weather's great.
Yeah, well, and actually the telepresence thing seems very, very nifty. I'm envious of that experience.
It was super, super, super fun.
Did people troll you, like stick their foot under your wheel or like hang a t-shirt over your camera or something?
So I'm moving my little tall, skinny Roomba around, but there's like five people walking with it.
Oh,
so,
okay.
It should have just been like, just release me. Let me see what happens. But they said, if we release you, someone's just going to take you.
Right.
So I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. There's that.
And now I'm in a car, apparently. We're going somewhere. Oh, I'm in a box truck now. Oh, now I'm in a shipping container. Huh. Okay.
The new flat Stanley.
Yeah, there was at one of the grocery stores that I frequent, there's a little, like, stick that sort of wanders around and just keeps an eye on you, chases after you to make sure you're not taking anything or whatever. It's got a little...
Just you or people
well,
in general?
It's supposed to be people in general, it's often in sight.
Okay.
But it has a little sign on it that says, you know, like I'm part of the... I don't know what it...
Meanwhile, there's just a broom in the corner and Paul's meds are wearing off. It's looking at me, man.
Sir, okay. There's no robot in this building.
You're in on it.
That's what they want you to say.
Yes. Yeah, the grocery cops are in on it.
Big grocery.
So it is the 259th episode, and we've been tracking the years that match with the episode number, and so that would take us to 1959. So we thought, you know, abstractly we would talk about some things that were related to the year. When one of the first things that comes up when you ask, you know, like ask Google what happened in 1959, is that COBOL was, I guess, I don't know, specified, invented, you know, brought to the world. So that's one thing we can talk about.
Well, most people know COBOL as a thing that led to Snowball, which I really, really like to talk about.
Right. So I, unfortunately, I think our main COBOL expert isn't here. So we were thinking that maybe this would be just sort of engagement generation, where we can say a bunch of wrong stuff and then people can write in saying, what are you talking about?
We'll get a lot of email.
None of those things were true.
Maybe some new hosts. This is how it happens.
That's right.
Exactly.
So COBOL was the first object-oriented language, and it was widely known as an interpreted language, specifically for calculators. Right. That was what was interesting about it.
Sort of ushering in the era of not needing to care about white space and columns.
Yeah, it was unique in that regard. I mean, we can say some basic stuff that we do know about it, I guess, which is that, what is interesting about COBOL is that it was specifically, the syntax was designed for punch cards. So it's specifically 80 columns, and every column is significant for a specific reason. And it's interesting. It's an interesting lesson in how you got to be careful when you design this stuff, because you're going to be stuck with it. And, you know, here we are, decades and decades later, and as most people probably know, a lot of banking systems and stuff still have some COBOL running in there somewhere, and so someone is still looking at that code, and it's still punch card syntax staring them in the face. So now I should say there's probably more modern versions of COBOL since then. Like, there's a COBOL 90, I think, and there's some other ones, so maybe that was dropped at some point. But at least originally, that was certainly an interesting property of it.
Grace Hopper played a role in this. I don't know if she, I think she developed a language before this that then became COBOL afterwards.
Oh, really? I thought she just developed it.
But
I had a vague memory that she was the one who started it.
Right. Well, I think that's correct. Although I think she did something before that as well.
Oh. I'm sure she did other things. Well,
right. But I thought it sort of came from something.
Okay.
Let's see, where is Wikipedia on this? Maybe I'll hide my search. But anyway.
Make you sound smarter.
Though while I looked that up, there were other things that happened in 1959 that we just looked up too, right?
The silicone chip, baby. So first chip was made from a block of germanium at Texas Instruments, and then around the same time is when Noyce, what was his name, Robert Noyce, makes the silicone version, so guess who wins. But Jack Kilby at TI made, and I think got the first patent for it, made like the first kind of thing that we would recognize as a silicone chip out of germanium, and then Noyce and Kilby kind of share the "Hey, they invented it" idea. And Noyce goes on to be, founder of Intel, little company that could.
Uh-huh. And silicon, for the record, there.
I was hearing that every single time. Yeah. I'm thinking.
I also was that. I will say it again to correct myself. There. Nope, keep saying it wrong.
Not the stuff you put around your bathtub.
No one probably noticed.
Different stuff. Robert Noyce. Yeah, I was going to say, do people just go around saying Noyce to him all the time?
Noyce. I invented a chip. Noyce.
Yes. Yeah.
And they do now.
This is the high quality technical content people come here for.
Yeah. COBOL was designed in 1959 by Codasil, and was partly based on the programming language Flowmatic, designed by Grace Hopper.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Flowmatic. That was Grace Hopper's thing,
too. So Paul did know a thing. That's awesome.
Paul gets a point.
I knew a thing, yes. I think it looks like the most current version of COBOL is COBOL 2014, so getting long in the tooth.
and yet it will not die.
That, almost everything that talks about, like, you know, COBOL is like, is COBOL dead? Answer, no.
No. Answer, have you used an ATM recently? Yeah, then no, it's not.
Yeah. Though and so there must be people who are currently learning it, you know, and as in order to be employed. But I've got to think that that is actually, that's got to be a sort of a smart move to learn COBOL and be one of the few who are then called upon when the bank, you know, the holder of all the money is in trouble.
Right. Exactly. What's your salary? I just take a percentage.
Exactly. Right.
It's a nice blob of COBOL you got running everything. Be a shame if something were to happen to it.
Yeah.
So let's talk raises.
So, I don't know, congratulations to COBOL on being invented.
I think, way to be born. I do think there's actually an interesting point buried in there about, is knowing COBOL valuable because of all these important systems that are running it? And I actually think the answer to that is no, at least in the industries that I've worked in, which include IT, console gaming, and mobile gaming. Languages that you knew were never prized. What we prized was your ability to learn a new language, right? And any software engineer worth their salt can learn a new language in a couple of days, at least the gist of it, and then kind of go from there. So I think that probably what actually happens is whatever software engineers already work at the bank, if they need to fix that code, they go and learn some COBOL in a hurry and fix it, rather than needing to call in a specialist or anything like that. Because, you know, programming languages are all basically the same. They all have the same basic structures and variable types and data types and so on. And it's just a question of, okay, what's the weird syntax I have to learn? And does it care about whitespace or not? And how do I compile it? And et cetera, et cetera. So,
and what is the punch card with? How do you turn this punch card machine on?
Yeah. good times. But yes, that's the only point I wanted to make, is that I don't think actually learning COBOL ahead of time is a wise use of your time.
Yeah, quite possibly. Also, there's a good interview of Grace Hopper on, you know, an ancient David Letterman show. If you have not seen it, you should watch it. She's great.
Look at that. That is a very old Grace Hopper and a very young David Letterman. I didn't realize that they overlapped.
Yeah. She's actually very, very funny, though.
Yeah.
She's like a stand-up comedian. She has a sort of a set of jokes that she has tested and work, you know, so you can hear her say those jokes many times, but yeah. Nevertheless, it's pretty great.
Well, I will definitely watch that.
Okay. Yeah. Well done us for covering 1959.
We faked our way through that. Nobody noticed.
I think the main main takeaway is 1959. Everybody says begins the second generation of computing. Mm-hmm. That's everything I looked at online before the show. It's like, it's a dividing line. Like, all the stuff we're looking at was one thing, and now we go into the next generation. All generations are all made up, he said, being part of Gen X. It's all just nonsense. But as much as one can divide these things, we're now entering generation two.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, human generations are nonsense, but I think technology generations are real in the sense that there's definitely a pivot from going from discrete transistors to that first level of integration onto chips, because, I mean, the possibility space explodes and the costs go through the floor instantly, and that is not nothing. So you know, building computers from discrete transistors is very difficult, and what you get is always going to be very slow and very expensive. And chips just, you know, blow all those restrictions out of the water. So, yeah, I think that's a fair line in the sand to draw.
Having drawn that line in the sand, we can move on to feedback. Let's see. So, I think I'll mainly just stick with the one feedback, and we'll come back to the other ones. The one feedback I will not talk about is the one about the ones compliment. We can talk about that next time.
Oh, how many wrong things did we say about ones compliment?
Oh, no, well, I think the main thing here I am skipping it, was it was alleged that it was crazy complicated, but it's actually kind of cool in a way to have a -0 and, and I kind of want to read the thing that we were pointed to. It's a whole you know, sort of part of computing that I do not know anything about.
Did you not take a comp sci degree?
I did not. No. So.
Oh, okay. That's if you take one, then yeah. You get it. Like this, or you're it's pushed on you. Like it's a thing. It's a welcome to computing. And I was like, wait, what's happening? Why are you teaching me this? Yeah, it was
day one. Let's learn about binary math from the 18th century. And you're like, what?
Yep. Yeah. No, I took the only actually, you know, like CS class that I took was a half class on parallel computing, which was actually quite interesting. It was sort of this was back in the dark ages or whatever, you know, so we wrote in unmodified C, you know, there's no pluses, no objective. It was just C on a little tiny parallel, you know, like processor farm. So we said, like, you compute this part of the fractal and you compute this part of the fractal and report back.
Because it was C, all the pointers went everywhere and it crashed.
Yeah.
No one ever successfully wrote anything.
Right. But it was a valuable life lesson that we learned. So, Michael wrote on over email on episode 257, we talked about printers. 257, that was two ago. Yeah. And so was pointing out that there were several things that we did not cover. A little list of things that were in Michael's list were parallel interface card problems for the Commodore computers. They were bulky and expensive. I think that's likely true of most. The lack of descenders on lowercase text on early printers.
That was a real thing. That was a pain. Yeah,
very weird little G's hanging up in the air.
Yeah, you can also still see fonts that are based on that.
Yeah,
exactly. I'll
the
see
P's
fonts all the time.
All
I'm like, oh, lately
shifted up. Yeah, it's like, I know why you did that.
Yeah, and makes it sort of hard to distinguish from the 9 and you know, whatever.
Well, and you guys talked about printing in text mode versus graphics mode, and graphics, you know, came along later. But that was one of the big deals about graphics mode printing on printers, is that you could have real descenders because you could send just a giant bitmap to the printer then. Yeah, that was a big deal with programs like Geos and Multiscribe and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Difficulty with getting diacritical marks, kind of the same thing. If you're trying to use a computer that was designed, you know, by a bunch of people who knew only English, and you're trying to write, you know, like French.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Michael says, I spent way too much time during my pre-med course hacking Paperclip's printer driver for my Star Micronics printer to get it to print French characters.
Excellent.
And I think I would have just started drawing things on the paper. But
that's what we used to do. So I would print my assignments in French classes on my Epson, which did not have accented characters, and I would go through and I would manually pen in
exact same experience.
Little accents, and it sucked because you would miss one sometimes that you had not missed in the word processor, because the word processor could do the accents, but the printer couldn't. And so I would miss some and I'd lose marks, and that was super frustrating.
Same.
I knew that was supposed to be there. Keep your red pen and stick it where the printer don't shine. Yeah. I was an angry student.
Yeah. And the last point that Michael mentioned was the worst was the omission of any mention of the greatest marketing campaign of 1983, the Gorilla Banana printer.
Wait, didn't we talk about that?
We may have. In fact, we might have talked about that. Maybe we talked about it like the episode after the one that that generated the interaction.
We definitely talked about this recently, or a show you guys. We've either talked about it or I've heard you guys talk about it on a show I wasn't on. Hmm. Definitely.
Yes, but it definitely. Got to get a little more definitely's in there. I remember this.
I don't think that's how definitely works.
I put on the screen this, you know, banana printer ad. And this has got, they bought like the inside cover space or something. Maybe it was on SoftDock or Nibble or something. This ad was always in front of me. Like, does it not look super familiar to everybody?
Oh, 100%.
Honestly, I don't know if I've seen this ad before, but looking at it now, it's very strange to me. Like, I've never heard of this company. Is this the only product they made? Was this printer called the Banana?
I don't know what role Gorilla plays in this, if it's the company or the product line, but it's actually it's a leading edge product. Like it's part of the leading edge computer empire.
Oh, okay.
So
I see, because it seems like Gorilla is the brand, and the printer is called the Banana, because it says "Meet the Banana," the very first tough dot matrix printer from Gorilla. So it's like they just created this brand to then brand the printer. This is all very.
Don't question the Gorilla.
This is some 80s shenanigans that I want to know more about.
Yeah. It may well have been, you know, the product of some drug-fueled evening.
Yeah, this feels like a just graduated with my MBA and I'm going to make my mark. And we learned about creating brands in school, so I'm going to create a brand around this printer, seems to be what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
Anyway. Wow.
I wish I could remember I was admonished by Microsoft Word for overusing something, and it was probably like usually or something. There was a moment in time when it's sort of grammar checker would say, you know, this word is overused, please use something else. And I think it was usually. But the problem is I cannot remember the warning. But I found it remarkable enough that I saved a screenshot. So sometime when someone else is talking about their story, I will find my screenshot. Okay. Anyway, we do not apologize for not talking about the Gorilla printer, because we did. I think it's a TLDR on that. But it was still remarkable. Anyway. Quinn, were there other things you wanted to say about printers?
Yeah, so Michael mentioned briefly about drivers. So that was the one thing I would have said on that show where you talked about it, if I had been there, was that what was interesting to me about printers was that it was my first experience with drivers, because like before that, drivers were not a thing in computing, right? Like you had certain peripherals, your floppy drive, your joystick, whatever, that the computer already knew how to talk to. It was in the hardware, and there was no such thing as drivers. That just wasn't a thing. And printers, I feel like, are where that idea was invented, because my first memory of a printer was when we got it. And for our Apple II Plus, and we got Print Shop the same day, and we were super excited to try out Print Shop and be able to print stuff, and we spent the entire day and could not get it to work. And sometime late the following day, we did finally get it, and the way we got it to work was by going through Print Shop's list of printer drivers and choosing them one by one and trying them until one of them worked. And I mean, Print Shop had like 200 drivers listed in it.
Ouch.
So it took 2 days to go through them all and just try them one after another, and one of them worked, and to this day, I don't know why or why not or what. And our printer was some sort of generic Epson-ish, clone-ish, you know, Taiwanese something or other with some animal or fruit name on it, I guess. But who knows what it really was inside. And it claimed to be Epson compatible, like they all did, and it variously wasn't. I mean, we went through all the Epson drivers and none of them worked. And anyway, so it was a very negative experience, honestly, and we finally got it to work and then just didn't touch anything for like 10 years, but it scarred me forever on the whole idea of drivers and that whole kind of ecosystem that we now live with. So I mean, luckily nowadays they've kind of gone back to being transparent again, but it took us a while to get back to that, weirdly.
Yeah, I had a lot of years of negative experiences with printer drivers. Like, oh my gosh, nothing sucked like
that. Yeah, that was a lot of why I just kept buying Apple stuff, was because I just knew I wasn't going to have to mess with drivers. Like, it was worth the 30% cost premium or whatever just to not have to, you know, install a driver to get my ImageWriter 2 to work or whatever. And it's funny, nowadays we've made so much progress on that that now it's weird if you do have to install something. Like, you get a digital camera or what was the other thing? The other day I had to install, and the thing came with like a QR code that I had to scan, and it downloads some software. I'm like, what are you installing and why? Like, this is a USB.
Yeah, what are you trying to install
on
my thing?
Yeah, this is a USB device. Like, there's just nothing you should need to install here. But it did. It didn't work until I installed something, and I'm like, it makes me uncomfortable now. Anyway, so there you go.
Michael's actually listening as we speak now, and and pointed out that the Gorilla Banana printer is probably a rebranded Seikosha GP100, same as the VIC-1525. So it is, the Gorilla Banana part is pure marketing, nothing else.
Nice. Oh, that actually, it was a retro thing. The thing that I had to install a driver for the other day, it was for the FTDI driver for the USB to serial converter. If you want to connect an old-fashioned serial port to a modern computer, you know, you have to use this little dongle, and that stupid dongle requires an FTDI driver on your computer. Mm-hmm. Again, why? Like, why does anything USB need a driver? But this thing does, and it doesn't work until you install it. It's very strange.
I found the screenshot, by the way. This is
What was it?
Microsoft Word version 6, I think.
Actually.
And, you know, the word was actually, right? So the screenshot says, I had typed the sentence, you know, I knew I actually remembered being advised on this by Word 5.1. 5.1, I guess it was.
Wow.
And it says, overuse modifier, use sparingly. You know, with the response to which is, you know I sparingly remembered being advised on this by Word 5.1.
That is very judgy for software from 1997 or whatever this is. Wow.
Yeah. But I for a long time after that, maybe even still today, I think of this 5.1 was the best version of Word. Like, that was the version of Word the last time it was nice.
So funny, your screenshot is in Mini VMac, which is showing a little black and white, you know, classic Mac screen, which only 512 by 384. And so being Word, about half the screen is used up with buttons and formatting things. And there's a little section at the bottom where you can actually
type. It's just toolbars all the way down.
Yeah, that is funny. There was a...
Thus began Microsoft.
I think maybe it was... is it David Pogue who had this? There was a column at the end of like Macworld or something like that, I think, with magazine, where it was just sort of like, you know, the last page kind of like commentary on stuff. And I've been meaning to try to track this down, but somewhere like he had made a prediction of like what Word was going to look like, you know, like two version hence, and it was really just like toolbars on every side and like a little square in the middle where you're typing.
Yeah, that we might be conflating memories here, but there was a thing in the late 90s that went around where someone actually just turned on every single toolbar that you could in Excel, because like 90% of them are off by default. So if you just actually turn them all on, you end up with this little postage stamp in the middle of a 27-inch monitor, and the rest is just toolbars all the way around, rulers and things. Yeah.
Excellent. I always imagine the Microsoft offices were like that. Like, all the staff were in the bottom three floors, and it was just all these floors of just tools and things above them. Got 37 stories, but we only lose the bottom three.
All right. Excellent. I think we will leave it at that. Next time I will try to organize the feedback a little bit better, but so it goes. We can now turn to our items of interest and news, and Carrington has the first of these.
Okay, so this is a ROM that you can download and then burn to an EEPROM and stick in your Model 1 or Model 3 TRS-80, and it's a diagnostic ROM. So I think it's cool. So if you've got a Model 1 or a Model 3, you're like, what is wrong with this thing? I can't figure out what's up. You can download this thing, do diagnostics on your TRS-80. So I think it's cool that people are making stuff like this. Quinn does ROMs, so she's impressed.
I guess this is super wonky and nerdy, but I love diagnostic ROMs. Like, you see them for various machines. People come up with new ones, and back in the day, there were, you know, technician ROMs that you couldn't buy yourself, but that the company would distribute to repair people that they would plug into the cartridge port or whatever, and it would do similar tests. And yeah, I think that's neat.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic way to diagnose hardware, especially you pick something up. Like, who knows where, right? Especially nowadays. Okay, let's just dive in. But something like this that's just going to check a whole bunch of systems and say, okay, here, like this does, you know, beeping things, checking things to get through, and just a great way to leap to problems. So I love it. I love diagnostic ROMs. So I was excited that this came out. I had a Model 1 many, 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 many years ago. If I got another one, I would totally get this.
There's actually a little animation of it running, too, on the little bit further down the – down, up somewhere on that screen.
Oh, down.
There it is.
Down.
Yeah. He just went by it.
That's not an animation. That's not an animation. That's an animation. That was up.
It's, and my mouse was upside down, I guess, maybe.
That was it. You had the you wanted the cord near you so it looked more like an actual mouse. I understand.
The mouse trying to get away from you, right?
Right, yeah. So that's why I keep it in my mouse pad. That was it. Short and sweet one for my first one.
All right. Quinn, you have the next thing.
I do, and this is actually a really cool one that I'm excited to share. So sharing on the stream here, I've got an episode of Computer Chronicles from 1988. And the focus of the episode, such a great show. The focus of this episode is on the Commodore 64, but it's in 1988. So it's actually the theme of this show is, OMG, how is the C64 still a thing? And it's actually pretty funny. All the hosts are going on and on about that, like the little 8-bit computer that could, and just like, we can't believe there's a scene where he walks through a software store and he's like, I can't believe there's all this Commodore stuff. Why is it still the thing? And yeah, so they were already doing that in 1988, which I think is hilarious. But the reason that I wanted to share this was because what's queued up here at the moment is the start of a piece on Berkeley Softworks. And way back in Open Apple episode number 52, Em and I did an episode devoted entirely to GEOS, and we talked to Robert Bowditch, and he was on the team, and he emailed us out of the blue a couple weeks ago, actually replying to the thread that the three of us had together from 2015, which always makes me laugh when that happens. And he sent this link to this video. I guess he was watching old Computer Chronicles episodes on YouTube, and he found this episode that they did. So they're in the Berkeley Softworks offices, and they're talking all about their development tools and how they're empowering themselves to create these powerful GUI applications like GEOS for, you know, what were then already considered obsolete machines like the Apple II and the Commodore 64. So it's a really cool little piece. You get to see inside their offices, so you get to see like what a software developer in 1988 looked like. It's really cool. They have so much space. It's kind of amazing. The open office concept had not been invented yet, thank goodness, so they all have like little rooms. It's great. Anyway, more to the point, it's a really fun look at what that actually looked like, that environment, and you get to see the people talking about GEOS, which always has a special place for my heart. We'll have this in the show notes. The GEOS part starts at about 2:45, so the link I put in the show notes is queued to the start of this piece of the story, but you know, Computer Chronicles episodes are always entertaining, so you can watch the whole thing. The only downside to this particular clip is that it's actually a really bad rip, so it's so blurry that you can't really read anything that's on the screens, but you know, it's like from a really old VHS tape, I guess, but it's worth a watch anyway.
Yeah, and the show is, the Computer Chronicles is a fun show to watch. Definitely.
Yeah, really.
I think it is also.
I mean, it's no Bits and Bytes.
Yeah, it's no Lubagoy.
Yes.
No one is.
And actually,
it is funny that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that it is funny that you know, if they're complaining about it in 1988, you know how crazy it is that there's still, you know, Commodore 64s in use. You know the Apple IIe that is on the screen, and you know that was still sold in 1993. I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's pretty funny that way. So I also threw up the Open Apple 52 where we talked to Robert Bowditch. So it's a great listen. I recommend that. There's also a link in there that I had actually forgotten about, which is that I put together an ultimate GEOS disk image for the Apple IIc Plus. It's a single 3.5-inch disk that has every GEOS product pre-installed on it. So if you want to experience that environment with all the bells and whistles, that's a great way to do it. And there's some stuff in there that was really hard to get back in the day. So there was a lot of applications in the GEOS family, and the GeoPaint and GeoWrite were the big ones that everybody had. But there was also like GeoSpell and GeoDictionary and GeoPublish. And there was actually a developer kit for GEOS, and a lot of that stuff either never made it out to the public or had very limited release. So there's some of that stuff in here as well that is worth checking out. So GEOS is super, super cool. I still love it.
That's cool. Yeah, I remember you saying you made that image, and I thought I should download that image, and I should download that image.
This is your reminder. Yeah,
I assume this link here in the Open Apple show notes still works. I have no idea where this is hosted. It might have been on my Google Drive, so maybe that link is long broken. If it is, let me know. I probably still have this disk image somewhere. But apparently we ran a contest where I had a secret message hidden on that disk image, and the prize was nothing at all. This is all coming back to me now. But
so everybody wins.
Yeah, there you go. That's, I did dig through the archives, but I knew we had talked to this guy at some point.
Yeah, and Michael in the comments asked if anyone actually used Geos to do something. And you did, right?
Oh, yeah. I was a hardcore Geos user. I used it exclusively. Like, I booted my Apple II into Geos and nothing else for like 5 years. I did all my school assignments on it. I published a newsletter with it. I had a phase where I was drawing spaceships. So I would draw spaceships in Geos all the time. And it was really, really good with printing. That was the other, speaking of printers, that was the other great thing about it is that it was very compatible. They had, I mean, you see in my list there on the show notes, there's two entire disks that were just drivers, and that was basically all printer drivers. So there was a printer driver for your printer guaranteed, and it was actually really, really good about telling you which driver to install. It would ask you these questions about your printer, like, where are the buttons, and what does the name on the front say, and it would figure out which driver you probably needed. So it was actually really good about that. And it would print, beautiful text, all the different fonts, proper descenders, all that graphics, mixed in. You could full desktop publishing, essentially, on an Apple IIe from 1988. It's pretty incredible. So, yeah, I used it a ton. And actually, I had a Commodore friend, too. A lot of Commodore users were really into Geos as well, because if you wanted to do anything besides play games on the Commodore, Geos was pretty much it. Like, that was your best option. And the Commodore version was equally good, although it was primarily joystick-controlled. Not very many people had the Commodore mouse, so most people were using it with the joystick, which was kind of clunky, but it was definitely usable. And if you wanted a proper word processor with fonts that would print properly, WYSIWYG editing, all that, Geos was pretty much it on the Commodore.
Yeah, it's one of the things I keep meaning to try and never have gotten around to.
Yeah. It will surprise you how modern it is. Like, you boot it up on an Apple II, and it's in double high res, black and white, so it's quite readable. And the metaphors of how scroll bars work and how buttons work in Windows and stuff, it all works just like you'd expect. Most of your instincts from modern GUIs will be correct. And it's shocking how modern it is for how old it is, and how little hardware it's running on. So it's quite remarkable.
Excellent. All right. Let's see. Carrington, you have the next thing.
Oh, I do. There's a new adventure game for the TI-99/4A. A person who goes by the name of Pixel Pedant. Great title. Put out a game and published it in the best, coolest way possible as a type-in program in a magazine. So it's just a PDF, and it's aimed to look as if it's Nifty 99er for magazine, August 2022. It's a type-in adventure game. I love it. I absolutely adore that this is how this got published. So it's huge. It's the PDF is designed so well. Mm-hmm. Like, it just looks absolutely like something from a magazine, with remarks and including at the very end the giant data statements that everyone must always type in. I just absolutely love this. It looks like a really fun game. If you want, the cassette version is also available. You can purchase, we'll have a link in the show notes, and it's called Hell's Halls, and you can purchase a cassette, a very limited run, for $25, $25 Canadian, yay for that, and get it in two variants, a clear case or a red case. So, and there's a variant of the game on the second side of the cassette. So just like everything about this is amazing. How absolutely delightful. There is, in tiny text at the very bottom, let's see if I can bring it up here. At the very bottom of the last page, it says, the user is therefore encouraged to regard typing in these 4,346 characters wholly without error as a fun and entertaining challenge. Which is just delightful.
That's excellent.
It's pretty. It does appear that the data is obfuscated in a way, too. So, like, when you type it in, that doesn't tell you how to solve the game.
Yeah. So it's just, it's done so well. Like, everything about this project is delightful. And then I'll switch over to the shop here where you can see the cassette version that's available. Again, $25 Canadian, in either clear or red cassette variants. Just everything about this is great. So I love this. It makes me want to get a TI just to play this game and type this in. What a perfect way to publish in a retro sort of manner.
This is- This is great.
Delightful. Perfect.
The code
execution.
Is beautiful. Like, if go flip back to that for a second. Like, the way that they've laid it out with, like, there's artwork embedded in it, and it's broken up into nice little modules, like startup sequence, level setup, dungeon generator. Like, back in the day, type in basic programs, it was just like 16 pages in Compute Magazine of gibberish that you had to type in. But this is like, you can they've actually laid out the program logically, and so you can type in little chunks at a time and actually understand how the program works as you're typing it in. So this is really cool.
Yeah, it's delightfully done. I was so impressed by this. So just absolutely love it. So if you missed the days of type-in programs, or you're younger and you want to check out what that was like, sit down and try to do this accurately.
Yeah, I will say, as beautiful as this is, I don't want to type that in, honestly. I don't miss that.
For 25 bucks, you don't have to.
I do not miss doing that.
Yeah, I think probably it would have to be a pretty short program before it started not seeming fun anymore.
Yeah. I mean, even at the time, yeah. I didn't like doing it. You did it because you were desperate for a game to play, but I don't think any of us ever enjoyed that process.
No, but I did learn a lot, like really, really early when I didn't know anything about programming, like type in things, maybe not something this big, just like typing in your basic commands and running it and seeing what didn't work and having to correct that really was a great way for me to learn like the beginnings of BASIC.
Fair enough. I did enjoy, like you guys talked about David Ahl recently. Similar to his books, like the Usborne books, they had a bunch of really short basic programs. And what was cool, I typed in all of those pretty much because they had a really good return on investment. It was like, you know, two small pages in a small book of code that would make like a playable game that was like fun for 20 minutes, you know, it took you 30 minutes to type it in and you could play it for 20 minutes and have a little fun. So that was totally worthwhile. That was worth doing. But like the other extreme was, so Nibble Magazine, I think the biggest one I ever typed in, Nibble Magazine did Nibble Racer. Do you guys remember that? It was on the cover. It was like a full first-person racing game with solid fill, like 3D, 2.5D graphics. And the thing was like, it was like 50 pages in the magazine of solid hexadecimal that you had to type in. And they had a fancy editor that would checksum each line so you would know if you made a mistake at least. But and I typed that thing in. And I regretted it immediately because the game was not that fun. But yeah, I spent 3 or 4 days typing that sucker in, and it was not worth it.
They did have some pretty impressive games, but maybe that wasn't one of them.
I mean, it was technically extremely impressive, I will say. Like, the fact that they did it at all was really, really cool. And I would probably appreciate it more now than I did at the time after I had just spent 4 days typing this thing in. But it was a lot of work, but no, their return on investment for the Usborne games is really cool, and they probably still are. Those books, I think, were a British and Canadian thing. I don't know if they were really much in the States, but I definitely recommend finding PDFs of those and typing them in.
Yeah, and I think we definitely had there was a news item, you know, like 7 years ago or something like that, where they were still publishing them or something like that, or they were made available somehow on their
site.
Right.
Yeah, you could buy them again or something. Yeah, that's right. They had the fun, like, they had the cute little robot explanations. Like, I think I've been on a show where we talked about this, because what I loved about it was the audacity of, like, teaching assembly language to 10-year-olds, which is what those books were doing. And so they had, like, this is a register, and there's little robots putting little pieces of paper with ones
in
and
the boxes,
zeros in the
right?
little mailboxes. Yeah, like, I love that they tried to do that at least.
But I have sometimes thought about, you know, like, I remember back when the Apple II was new and I was a kid and I had this thing. I was not very old and I was, you know, I was doing machine language. I mean, you know, it's possible for people to do this.
It is, yeah.
So, but, you know, from now as an adult looking down to where the kids are, it does sort of seem like that's kind of crazy. But when I was on the other end of that, it seemed pretty possible. So
for sure.
Yeah. Jeremy says that he typed that one in, probably that racer one.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And without the fancy editor.
Oof. Oh yeah. You need
oh,
the checksum.
Yeah. Without that.
My goodness.
God, 'cause then you had to triple check every line, especially the assembly language ones. 'Cause if you made a single mistake, the whole thing wouldn't work and you'd never know why. Like, gosh. Yeah. Brutal.
All right, let's see. Okay, Hell's Halls. That's right. That's what this item was. There was actually something that came up. Let's see if I can find the thing to show here. Somebody had posted a thing about. Do you guys know the Masters of Doom book? It came out a little while ago.
Yep, I remember that.
So a little while ago being 2003. but it was, it's basically the story of id software and the, bringing in, Doom and all that. And apparently there was a TV series that was going to be made of this. And, so the pilot was actually shot. What am I looking at? I'm looking at, the IMDb entry for this. They had actors, they had everything set. The pilot was shot, and somewhat sort of recently, it sort of came up again. And this came very recently to my attention. I didn't see it at the time, but apparently the pilot. So someone had posted about, I just watched the pilot for Masters of Doom, which tells the story of how Doom came to be, and there's a chance none of you will ever get to see it. It was one of the best episodes of TV I've ever seen. So we now know that there was a pilot, and we can't watch it.
That is news to me.
But one of the things that kind of brought this up, let's see if I can actually make this scroll to the right place, is that some shots from the pilot were... became available. So I'm kind of scrolling around here trying to find them.
I know that pool set. I just watched a movie with a scene in that set. That's funny.
But yeah, so this is Jasmine Cho's portfolio site has some stuff. I think she did like set design and stuff like that for them. But so there's pictures of the building of, and then the actual soft disk offices.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, so we don't get to see the pilot, but we get to see some
stuff
pieces
from
it because it's in this person's portfolio. Oh, that's great. I love this.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it keeps scrolling away from me. But and also a pretty nice, Applefest San Francisco 1989 setup where you can see, Byte and other stuff. And so
that's great.
I really want to watch this.
Yeah. These really have made it.
They recreated that 80s trade show vibe with like the bad curtain walls and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
God, that's great. And the 70s soft disk offices. Wow. Fantastic.
Yeah. So yeah, it is unfortunate that this is, I guess this is the way I should have done it. There's on Reset Era or Reset Era or something like that. There is a, some thread where, this is being discussed, but.
Let's be honest, it's going to leak at some point. Like some intern somewhere will find this file and quietly post it. So it's only a matter of time till we get to see it.
I hope so.
In this day and age, everything leaks in this day and age.
Yeah. Though I think it's been like a year or something since it kind of like faded away. So, but definitely I would like to see it.
If it gets some press like this, then that's probably someone who works, who might have access to this in some storage room or whatever will be like, I bet I can find that. And then suddenly it'll be out there.
The long reach of RCR.
Exactly. Well, I was referring to this famous person that was tweeting about it more than us,
right.
But we'll take credit for it when it does leak.
Anyway, I hope, if nothing else, we could get more photos of these offices. It's really pretty cool to see. And actually, somewhere there was also John Romero responded to the tweet saying, something sort of like, I really want to see this. I haven't seen it. I really want to see it. I'm not sure what I'm missing since I lived it, but I want to see it.
I mean, it might make him mad. Is it a fictionalized recreation? It's not a documentary, right? Like they have actors and they're recreating stuff.
Yeah.
So it might end up being kind of dramatized and get a lot of the facts wrong, which might just anger the people that actually lived it.
Yeah, that is possible. Because I think it is, it is dramatic. Is the idea. But
I would like to point out that it was bugging me, so I did some Googling, and the movie I was thinking of was something called The Paper Tiger.
That is, in fact, her.
It's a really fun film. And then I found the thing you were looking at. I'm like, that is the set. So it actually is the set. It's very weird that something about that pool was so, I'm like, I watched a movie with that set. So well designed, I guess. Yeah. Like just an empty swimming pool, maybe you immediately know what movie it's from.
Yeah, I recognize the name from, you know, the thing that was scrolling by, but I don't. Was the movie good? Or was just this pool?
Yeah,
good?
It was okay. Really good. Yeah. It was funny, like three fellows who were at one point like great kung fu masters, but are now well past their prime, have to defend their master's honor, but they can barely move now. So it's actually a really good movie. I liked it a lot. But yes, I remembered the scene. I remembered that set. So that was weird.
It would be cool to see the reference photos that they used for those sets, like the soft disk offices and stuff. I'd love to see the photos that they were looking at to recreate them. That would be neat.
I really want to see Masters of Doom now, though. It's going to eat at me until I get to see it. So somebody's got to leak it.
Hurry up.
I mean, there is that Netflix documentary on video games that probably has a lot of the same content in it, right? They had a whole episode, I think, about Doom or it in general. I haven't seen it yet, but everyone's talking about it. The History of Video Games or something it's called.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, there was, as I recall, didn't they like interview Becky Heinemann or something in the first one? And then that's as far as I got.
Yeah, I think maybe, yeah.
All right. Well, something to watch in all my free time, among the other things that I have to watch.
Yeah, it came out years ago. I haven't seen it yet for the same reasons, because I've been too busy. But yeah, everyone says it's good.
All right. And now we can turn to Apple One Video Memory, which is the next thing I think.
I guess I had the next one as well. Okay, so let's see. So this is, I was shocked that this had not already been covered, but maybe it has, and I should have asked and didn't. This is Ken Sheriff's blog. We talk about a lot. And what I liked about this one, so it's a deep dive into the Apple One Video Memory. And I didn't realize there was anything weird about Apple One Video Memory. Just when you thought Apple Video Memory couldn't get any weirder, the Apple One says, aha, challenge accepted. And so we all know that the Apple II Video Memory is a crazy layout, and it's on DRAMs, and it has this crazy layout because it saved a bunch of chips. Well, as many of you probably know, back in the day, by far the number one cost driver of these computers was RAM. RAM was just obscenely expensive, like 64K they used DRAMs because those were cheaper than SRAM, but DRAMs require refreshing, so all these retro computers do crazy things to keep the DRAM refreshed, the Apple II being famous for having arguably the most clever way of doing that, which is that it used the video scanner to refresh the DRAMs on alternate clock phases. And so that was an annoying compromise that they had to make because DRAM was slightly cheaper than SRAM. So RAM being the, you know, 64K of DRAM was like $1,000 in 1980, right? So that was by far the biggest chunk of what you were buying with your $3,500 Apple II. So the Apple I now is a few years before this, and so RAM was even more expensive. So the way that they solved this problem was, being as clever as he is, they just didn't use RAM at all. So the Apple I video memory is actually shift registers, which are kind of like memory. They store bits, but you can only access those bits by pushing them in one end and popping them out the other end. It's one long serial queue of bits. And what's super clever about this is not only did that save a ton of money, but it actually makes a lot of sense for the Apple One, because it's just a text terminal and the text just scrolls upwards. So a shift register is a perfectly reasonable way to represent that. If you have one long shift register of bits, that's all of your characters on screen at, say, 40 by 24, that's 320 bits per row of text, assuming, you know, one byte per character. So if you want to scroll your text up, the cool thing about it using a shift register is you kind of get scrolling for free. If you want to scroll your text upwards, you just pump 320 clock cycles into your shift register and all the text is going to go up one line. And on a scrolling text style terminal, you're only adding text at the bottom, right? So you're pushing bits up into the bottom of that shift register and it pushes all the text up for you. So it's hardware scrolling kind of for free. So it's actually a really clever solution. Now, of course, the massive price that you pay for this is you don't have random access to any text positions. So you cannot do like VT100 terminal emulation, for example, because you can't change characters anywhere in the middle of the screen. If you want to change a character anywhere, you have to push an entire new copy of the screen into memory, which I did the math on this would require 7,680 clock cycles, or about 7 milliseconds or 8 milliseconds, which is a lot for a single screen refresh of just text. 8 milliseconds is an eternity, so that rendered any sort of interactive text basically useless on the machine. But I just thought it was a really cool solution that I didn't know about, and this being Ken Sheriff's blog, he doesn't just describe that, he actually also then takes microscope photos of the die and explains how the layers of silicon actually interact to create all the transistors in the shift registers and how they generated the clock pulses and yada, yada, yada. So goes way, way deeper than I just did, but it's a really cool cost-saving measure and very, very clever. So yeah, every time I think I've figured out all the clever things Woz did, I read something like this and I'm like, nope, still more cleverness to be found.
The actual, like, the chips that you need to get, you know, if you're building an Apple I recreation, those are hard to get now.
Yeah, I believe it.
I mean, not only they're hard to get, and you need, like, what, 8 of them or something, right? I mean, like...
Yeah, because these are really big shift registers. Like, it's 680 bits of shift register, which, I mean, you can buy shift registers nowadays that are, like, a 74595, which is 8 bits. So, I mean, you'd need hundreds of them on your board. So these are very, very big, very dense shift registers that he was using. So, yeah, I don't know if you can still even get those.
You can for a very high price, you know, pulled off of some other thing.
Yeah. Yeah, because, of course, nowadays, I mean, you would just put an SRAM in there because it's way cheaper and way easier and way more powerful. RAM has now become so cheap that it's a commodity. But, back then, RAM was just unbelievably, incredibly expensive.
It is funny. One of the games that you can play on your Apple One is a lunar lander. And the way that works is that you sort of type in, like, what thrust you want to get, and it will tell you. It will report back, you know, the stats of what happened. It's not anything at all interactive. There's also no backspace. I mean, which makes sense. Like, you know, if you want to back up in the sort of like input memory, you type an underscore and just believe that it's a backspace.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's the funny thing is that you can't, with the shift register text, with shift register memory, you can't move the cursor. So, again, without incurring a 7 millisecond penalty to redraw the entire screen. So it's a little thing that you might not think about, but totally changes how the machine has to function, basically, if you can't move the cursor anymore. Or I guess you can only move it forward in time, as it were.
Santo News Sephora in the chat says that the DEC VT05 terminal used shift registers in 1970, and I think it was a fairly common technique. It might be that it wasn't Woz's own.
Yeah, that's fair. Brilliance. That's fair. I'm giving him all the credit there, but I'm sure it was actually a pretty popular technique, again, because it's such a good fit for scrolling pages of text. And shift registers were used in other similar ways as well, so it wasn't an original idea. Like, shift registers are often used for generating video memory addresses in video scanners and things, which is a very, very similar application. So it's not much of a leap to say, okay, I'm going to use it for the text page as well. So I'm giving Woz a lot of credit there, but that's a good observation. And it's also, though, just an interesting reminder of how much of a cost driver RAM was. I mean, we all lived it, but I think we forget how, like, people think that the most expensive part of the computer must have been the CPU or the graphics or the floppy drive or whatever, the things that we think of as being expensive. But no, it was like 80% of the computer you were buying was the RAM, was the cost of the RAM. And I think it's fun to be reminded of that. The hoops that they jumped through and the compromises that they made to try and get that cost down is pretty interesting.
I know I've somewhere heard, you know, that the Apple One is being kind of described as, you know, like a terminal. Essentially, like, there's a terminal part and there's a CPU part, and they're just kind of like stuck together.
Yeah, well, and as I always like to say, all of these retro computers are actually just video generators with a CPU and some RAM hanging off of them. The video generator is the technically difficult part. The RAM is the expensive part, and the video generator is the technically difficult part, and all other decisions in the computer design decisions were made around the needs of the video generator. Everything from the clock speed to what support chips you had to what your memory map was to what your video layout was, it was all around the needs of the video generator.
Yeah. So, yeah. I think that's true. Like the Apple II, if I'm only vaguely remembering this, but there's some like weird hesitation that the CPU does, you know, every some number of cycles. Yeah. I think specifically to stay, you know, in sync with the TV.
That's right. Yeah, because I think it's something to do with the NTSC refresh is like a fractional rate or something, and so there's a rounding error that accumulates in the 1,020,230,000 or whatever clock cycles per whatever. So yeah, every so often it has to like have a leap cycle, if you will, like a leap second, but a clock cycle to stay in sync. Yeah.
Excellent. It's just keeping the emulator writers, you know, busy.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of it is that NTSC is monstrous. Like that's if people are interested in video at all, like read the history of NTSC and why it is that way and why, and the technical details of it, because they're absolutely terrible. It's just the worst designed video standard you can possibly imagine. And it was all designed that way to remain compatible with older black and white televisions. They were jumping through insane hoops to remain compatible with whatever TV, whatever round screened oscilloscope TV that grandma bought in 1951, they had to stay compatible with. Yeah, and it's just everything about that video standard is horrible, from the way it interlaces to the fractional refreshes to the terrible frame rate that they chose and all of that stuff. And it was also designed to compress bandwidth as much as possible, but because they were worried about they didn't have a lot of bandwidth because like there was radio stations were taking up all of it, and everyone, you know, radio was like the 800-pound gorilla of the time, so they had to accommodate radio people. But anyway, I'm babbling, but long story short, NTSC is monstrous, and thus retro computers are weird because they had to accommodate it.
Curtis in the chat talks about the artifacting. NTSC is never the same color.
Yeah, very true.
And I think the other thing they were trying to dodge was electrical buzz, right? I mean, like,
yes.
so that instead of being at some like nice integer number, they had to like pull it down just a little bit so that it would not, you know, sync up with
the
electrical signal.
Yeah, that is true.
So what is it, 2997? These are the numbers you need to know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, right. 29.97 FPS. Yeah.
Anyway, all right. I guess that's the news, as it were.
And that's the news from 1970.
After the news comes a word from our sponsor.
Why buy just a video game from Atari or Intellivision? Invest in the Wonder Computer of the 1980s for under $300. The Commodore VIC-20. Unlike games, it has a real computer keyboard. With the Commodore VIC-20, the whole family can learn computing at home. If you want games, the Commodore VIC-20 has a super selection. Under $300, the wonder computer of the 1980s, the Commodore VIC-20.
Available at all 5 Wilco stores.
Two new smash hits from Atari.
Long ago, in the distant future, where evil knights joust upon beasts of the air, now you can fly. In Joust, you don't just play it, you live it.
And in distant worlds, they love it on Nebula. They're wild about it on Terranus. Moon Patrol, bounce your buggy over moon craters. Zap flying saucers. Moon Patrol, you'll eat it up.
Joust and Moon Patrol, new from Atari.
And we're back. And the host retro competing gift idea was something Carrington found and will now describe.
I just read about this, actually. I just read a couple of reviews while we were talking so I could learn about this thing. So this is a game. Atari put out a bunch of games, or there were Atari is a thing and does stuff. But a few years ago, and we've talked about them, there were some arcade-based board games, and they were Atari ones. There was Centipede, Missile Command, and I don't know, one other one. But this is a different thing that I had known about, and it's not Atari. It's Joust, which would be a Williams game, I think, right? Yeah, Williams. It's a board game. Midway, of course. Board game of Midway Joust. So that kind of tells me what it is. Of course, it would be super lasers if it was a.
And it would have those that great explosion sound that just like
right. It would all sound the same. I did not know. I think I didn't know that this existed. So if you like computer/arcade things turned into board games, and I haven't really played many of these, but something about them really appeals to me. I want to get all of these and bring them all to Kansas Fest and have buddies play with me. I think it's the only place I will ever get anyone to be interested in playing any of these games with me, even once. Played the Lode Runner game at Kansas Fest. Yeah, I had a lot of fun. So this is a terrible joust game, though, board
game. Oh, it's terrible. Yeah.
Whatever. It's fun playing games with your friends. Even all these games. They're all terrible. It doesn't matter. This one looks quite interesting. So I've read a couple of reviews, and if you're a fan of the Joust arcade game, which I am, it's a game I really like. It's a very fun two-player game in particular. For $30, you can pick up the Joust board game, available from a bunch of different places. The reviews I've just read make it actually sound quite interesting, because it's a programming game, so that works well. So programming games are the kind where you determine ahead of time what your move is going to be, and you set it down, but hidden. Everybody sets down their moves, and then they're all revealed at once, and then you kind of play them out. So your second choice can be affected by other people's choices you don't realize. And so you're given two controls for the little joust player you're moving around on the screen, which is a momentum control, and flap tokens, which is perfect. So you can lay down, I'm going to flap this many times. And you move around trying to knock other people off their flying ostriches, they're birds. just like the arcade game. So it's super fun. Up to four people can play, and you lay down your flap tokens. You say, I'm going to try to move west and flap five times. You don't realize somebody else is going to flap more or less, and you bounce into them, and you might get unseated. And looks like a really fun version of the Joust arcade game. So I might actually pick this up and bring it at some point to a future Kansas Fest, because this looks
really fun.
This is
a modern game, right? Not a... Okay.
It is a modern game, yeah. Published just a few years ago, available now in a ton of different places. Looks readily available from lots of places.
It looks like a modern game. Like, the production values on it are really high, which is very much a modern thing. So that's really, actually looks kind of fun. I mean, there was a period in the 80s there where they were making board games and breakfast cereals out of every video game. There was a Pac-Man game and a Q-Bert game, yes. And they were all terrible. I had the Pac-Man one, which was kind of neat, because it actually had all the maze, and there was a little hole in the board, like actually a die cut hole in the board everywhere there would be a dot, and you had this huge bucket of marbles, and you put a little marble on each hole, and then you had a plastic Pac-Man contraption where you could kind of like Hungry Hungry Hippos, where you move this Pac-Man thing around on the board and it would eat the marbles. The game was dumb, but it was physically interesting anyway. But this looks like fun.
So anyway, that's our choice this time to add to our host gift guide. Buy it for somebody who's got nerdy friends.
Very excellent. All right. And once you're done buying that for your nerdy friends or friends of nerdy friends, we can now turn our attention to eBay. And Carrington has some things that he's going to try to convince me to buy.
I do have indeed a couple of different things. I've gone gaming again. The first is, I'm now sharing it. The first is the PlaySchool Play and Learn computer. Now, you might think, oh, a little play computer for kids. But since this was put out in 1972, it is, of course, a mainframe. And I think it's delightful. So it's a mainframe computer. Didn't take any batteries. Didn't take any wind-up, anything. Kids could run them on their own. It comes with a bunch of cards. And how the game works, and this is an inbox with all six cards. I think the idea was you could get other punch card type things later, but only came with the six. You place the cards in the top of your mainframe computer, and then the young kid moves the left reel, a giant reel to reel on top of this thing. I'm trying to paint a picture. So imagine this is a giant reel to reel computer. And the reels have little pie wedges missing from them, so that when you place the card in, parts of the cards are exposed in the little computer reels. You dial on the left reel to expose an item, and then there's like a question, like, and this will be like, oh, what, you might be using the card that says, like, what is the sound this makes, or the color of this, or whatever. And then on the right reel, you dial the answer that you think is correct, but then you press the button, the big red button in the front, and it automatically moves the right dial to the correct answer, so a kid can know if they got the answer right or not. So it is an interactive mainframe computer from 1972 by PlaySchool. I think it's absolutely delightful. I think it's just a wonderful little thing. And this is like a new, it's not totally new, but it looks super new. And it comes with the box, comes with the cards. I think it's a great little toy. So if you've got a kid in 1972, This looks like a very good use of $20. So how fun is this thing? So I just love it. $20, buy it now.
That is
delightful.
Really,
I think
yeah,
that's Paul needs
really
this.
Cool. The condition of it is incredible. I mean, the box looks brand new.
Yeah.
I mean, and $20. I mean, vintage. I would think vintage toy collectors would be all over this.
And it's not a super rare item. There's a bunch of these on eBay now, but this was the nicest. Most of them are kind of beat up and they're missing the cards. And this one looks like it just got unboxed yesterday.
Yeah. Wow. I wonder how it works, how it knows which of the other positions is the answer to whatever position you're on. So,
that's a good
kind of
question.
Simple mechanism inside, I guess, because, there's no batteries, right? So it's...
Yeah. Huh. It could be the answers are always in the same position.
Yeah, maybe it's always...
Like if you put the dial
it's always
right,
four advanced from
five.
Where you are or something, yeah.
Yeah. But the only way to know is to spend the $20, mm-hmm. Paul. That's the only way to know.
I guess that's true. Well, you could try refreshing. Because I think it should show as sold.
Oh.
Did you just buy it? Did we get an on-air Paul buy?
I think I did. Anyway, we'll see. But
amazing.
I have seen these before. They are, and this one is in very good condition. I'm quite impressed with that.
Yeah, it looks brand new. It's really amazing.
But it is a good sort of decorative object too.
Exactly. So I've seen lots of computer toys that I've considered before. Like the Barbie has a great one that's like a stand-up console thing. It's just like amazing looking computer. But I've never seen one that's in great condition to choose it as the gift. And this is the first time I've encountered this in such a nice condition. I'm like, I'm going to finally choose one of these toy computers from the 70s. So my second choice, we'll see if I can sell Paul two for two. I don't think I've ever sold you two things in a show, Paul. And we'll see. And this one will be a hard sell. It is an Avalon Hill game called Class Struggle.
That's pretty funny.
Which I find to be the strangest Avalon
Hill
game. Is
that Karl Marx?
I think of them as... Yes, it's Karl Marx arm wrestling Rockefeller on the box cover.
Wow.
This is an odd... Very odd game. I think of Avalon Hill games as being war games, SSI games. It's normally like the Panzers attacking and war things, right? This is Class Struggle, where you learn to defeat capitalism in America in the 1920s. I do think it's the weirdest thing.
It really looks like it's a variant on the original game from which Monopoly was derived.
Well, see, that's the thing. I also have been reading about this during the show, and I put post-it notes before. And it turns out that, yes, there was a game that Monopoly was derived from, and which was made by Quakers, or a Quaker. And then the idea of Monopoly kind of originally was to say everybody starts with the same thing, and it kind of teaches you that one person ends up with everything, and that's bad. And that's really not the lesson most people take from Monopoly. Most people take the lesson, it's a terrible game, and we're playing it wrong or whatever. All the pedants will write and say, you're playing it wrong. It's a terrible game, whatever. So Class Struggle turns out to have also been a fairly popular board game. So here is, for £270, you can buy a copy of the actual board game from ages ago. Class Struggle to prepare for life in capitalist America, an educational game for kids from 8 to 80. Yeah, 8-year-old kids are going to just adore this game. This board game is the same. So this is what this was based on, I guess. In fact, I read that the person who made the Class Struggle board game sold the rights to Avalon Hill, and then they put out the computer
version. For like some crazy low amount of money, like losing a ton on like what Monopoly
Because it was losing a ton of money, because this Marxist decided to make a board game and then to sell it in a capitalist society and sold it to a bunch of like radical game stores, all of whom said, well, why should I pay you for this? And so they would take the game and sell it and then not send any money back to the manufacturer as like a class protest. And so the Marxists was like, well, can't we protest other people instead of just me? And so we basically went out of business and sold the rights to Avalon Hill. It's all a cautionary tale. The board game itself looks quite handmade, to be honest, or not like super professional, but it's a very early board game. Is it worth £270? It is not, but I don't know that you should necessarily have to pay for it. the whole thing is very weird. I went down a whole rabbit hole about class struggle and Marxist games, but my actual choice for this episode is the Class Struggle Avalon Hill computer game, new and unpunched. Yeah. For $200.
That looks great.
A tougher sell. Yeah. If I was to refresh this,
it'll still be there.
Would it say that it sold? Okay.
I'm actually not familiar with this game. I've seen
me
a lot of
them. Me neither. That's what caught my eye. You see so many Avalon Hill games that are all the exact same game. And then suddenly there's this one of Karl Marx arm wrestling somebody. I had to look up who's arm wrestling. It looked like Santa Claus arm wrestling some D-bag. Yeah. And it turns out it's Karl Marx, you know, arm wrestling a D-bag, Rockefeller. I was right about that part. So, new, unpunched. I don't know if it's a particularly rare game, but I hadn't seen it before. So.
And what's the floppy disk that's with it? It has an Apple II disk in it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so like a lot of Avalon Hill games, this is kind of half board game, half computer game. So, you play on an actual board, and the computer is going to do parts of it or something. I don't know.
Just to make it clear why we're talking about this on the Retro Computing Roundtable podcast.
Yeah. Right, yes. See, not just a Marxist statement. It's a very weird looking computer game for the Apple II from 1984.
Yeah, they're definitely, I mean, Avalon Hill and SSI both had, you know, these sort of like financial based games as well. I don't know if they were fun.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of those. Right.
But, I mean, I guess if you like the sort of thing, you like that sort of thing.
The weird thing about this is when I was looking up the board game it was based on, there was the first edition of the board game, which is I think the one I've got. I was just showing you guys on eBay. And then there's a second edition board game on the back of which it says, the first edition sold out in a month. This is a really popular game. You should buy it. Then the Avalon Hill version, which I'm showing now, on the back of its box, it says, the first edition sold out in a month, which is implies that the first edition of the computer game sold out in a month. But this is just the art from the back of the second edition of the board game. So the board game sold out in a month, but they might have made 10 of them.
Right.
Because it was like a handmade board game. Of course it sold out. He sold one. So. But in case somebody's been looking for this game that I've never heard of before, there you go.
And they might have. I mean, you know, because
they might have.
The story that sort of like, you know, leads to Monopoly itself, you know, is kind of it's an interesting tale of its own. You know, I could see people wanting this for that.
This does not look like a fun game.
No.
This looks like a game that you're instructed to play. Like, okay, kids, we're going to learn.
This is like something your social studies teacher would make you play when the VCR is broken and he doesn't want to teach. Yeah.
So these are my choices. Right. I sold Paul one thing. I'm okay with that.
No, I'm pretty impressed with that. The sort of like display mainframe, play school.
Right.
My first mainframe. Anyway, I'll report back. Maybe I'll show photos of it in my office or something.
Yeah, you got to hold it up on screen. We'll wait.
Okay, great. All right. I guess I'm next. So I had just, you know, sort of had random things that I found on the way to the show today. But the first thing that caught my attention, just it seemed, I don't know, interesting to talk about, is this is it's a Bell & Howell Apple II Plus. And we've probably talked about these before, but, you know, the thing that makes them special is that they were kind of marketed to schools. And so they were kind of like a collaborative enterprise with Bell & Howell, who made, like, you know, overhead projectors and stuff like that for schools. And what's special about them is that they are black, you know, so it's like painted black, and it has a badge that says Bell & Howell and Apple on it. And they have a keyboard that's got black keys as well. So they're, you know, they're sort of collectors like them. This is a particularly terrible one because the
way to sell it.
I mean, the keyboard, it's hard to find, you know, replacement keys for this because they're rare and they're not like the regular Apple II Plus keyboard. And so with this and many of the keys on this one were apparently damaged. And so,
but at least they didn't try to match either the shape of the key or even what the key would be.
Or the orientation or anything. I mean, like, so I like the, I was trying to figure out what was going on there to the right of the M, you know, because it seemed like there was a V and then a little symbol and then another one that had like a symbol and then a V. But it turned out, no, actually, that's, those are greater than and less than signs, you know, turned 90 degrees.
Wow. Not even the orientation.
Right. That's what that is. That's great. And since you don't use the Z key much, you just get a second Y in place of that, which I'm like, sure, why not? Yep.
What is this?
If you're a touch typist, maybe it doesn't matter.
I would actually be interested to know where they took these keys from, because the top right one says says end field begin. So that sounds like it's off some weird mainframe terminal or something. That's kind of what that sounds like.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, like the computer itself is sort of, you know, it's an interesting thing. It's a, of mild rarity, you know, that's, people do collect them. I don't know what actually we're looking at now. I'm just sort of skimming through the pictures and we seem to have a picture of like a dog.
they just threw a picture of their dog into the listing. I love that.
Yeah. Orientation, you know, sort of like, rotational orientation does not seem to be a thing with this person, since all the pictures of the manuals are sideways.
Well, they're only asking $3,000, so why put any effort in?
I guess that is. They've also included the Apple Macintosh primer here in case you you know, want to upgrade at some point.
So this is someone that found a box of this stuff in their parents' attic or something and was like, Googled black computer and found this, and they're like, oh, these go for a lot of money, and so, yeah, they just listed everything that's in the box.
Yes. So my the auctions that I put up are often, you know, for comedic value and not for value. But, the next thing, I thought this was actually kind of interesting, just sort of from like a completeness packaging perspective. It's an Echo 2 speech synthesis board and speaker for the this is also for the Apple II, and I remember like the elementary school I was at had one of these things. I'm not sure if they had the speaker, but they may have, but I remember playing with it and just having the computer, you know, speak, trying to make it say, you know, whatever a elementary school child would make a computer say.
Same things I try to make it say. Right. Now
but did you guys have any experience with these in life?
No, I never saw one in person. I know that they had the same speech chip in them that the Mockingboard was compatible with, right? Basically the same speech chip that was in everything in the 80s, that phoneme generator thing.
That's in the Speak and Spell.
In the Speak and Spell, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, right, yeah, the LPC, yeah.
This, again, though, this is, that box is in incredible condition.
Yeah. Agreed,
it's brand new. It's still got the closure sticker on it. That wraps around the opening. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Unfortunately, there's only the one photo. it does. It is in really good shape. So if you're looking for this, also seems to have, I don't know what that is. Is that a port cover for a 2GS sitting there by the card? It might be.
That's what that looks like,
does,
to me.
Yeah.
Unless the coloring's off on the photo and it's a port cover for 2E, and the whole thing's way more yellow than this photo makes us think.
Anyway, this is, you know, it's going on auction. It has 5 days, almost 6 days left, and is currently at under $17. So this is going for whatever the market will provide. So it's a pretty good auction, actually, I think, in Illinois.
I think we've talked about this before, but I would be very tempted by something like this just to get that speech chip out of it, because those speech chips are unobtainium. And so to be able to buy a thing like this for $16 and get one of those chips to stick on my Mockingboard, not going to lie, a little tempted, but I guess I would feel bad.
Pretty sad.
Yeah, I would feel bad destroying such a perfect example of this peripheral, but it's tempting, I'm not going to lie.
It seems like if they can make, you know, can they make new SID chips? Maybe they can't. But if they can, they should be able to make these too.
Yeah, there are some reproductions of the SID, but none that are like original silicon. The problem with the SID is it had analog elements right on the die. So that's basically impossible to reproduce without recreating, you know, MOS's production line. So what they have, what you can buy though, are reproductions that use like FPGA or other things to kind of fake what the SID was doing. But yeah, so we'll probably never get real SIDs again. But yeah, I'm sure you could do the same with this. You could create a modern custom chip that emulated it. I don't think the demand is high enough that anyone has necessarily bothered doing that. But yeah.
Yeah. Since this has one photo kind of zoomed out, you don't know that somebody hasn't already yanked.
That's true. There might be nothing inside. Like, that, I mean, that happens with Commodores. You buy a lot of Commodores and the SID has been ripped out of it because people use them for other things and people want to replace the SID in theirs, or there are dual SID setups you can run for stereo on the Commodore. So a lot of people buy old Commodores to rip the SID out of it, which is pretty annoying if you're trying to buy one.
Yeah. I think you can probably see well enough on this card that they're, you know, like the doesn't look like any chips are missing. They've only just rubbed it against the carpet.
Yeah. It's all static zapped, but it's present.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Okay, let's see, what else do I have? Oh yeah, I always think these are just kind of cool, just in that they exist. So this is two software packages by Estes, which are, it's like a model rocket company. And you know, I'm not actually sure what the software does, but it's, you know, one is physics of model rocketry and one is flight aerodynamics of model rockets. And you know, so they're in nice looking little packages, and they have little Apple discs, and it's, you know, it's the kind of thing you might not have known existed. So
what do you think they do though? Is it teaching you about model rockets, or use it to,
well, let's see,
not to program a rocket.
There was screenshots on one of the pictures. If you zoom in
for the back, yeah,
like go to,
where were we? Here we are. There.
Yeah, okay, maybe so, zoom in on that. You might be able to tell what it's doing.
Let's give it a try. I think it has been imaged, so it looks. Yeah, it does look like it's teaching you about like how the model rocket, you know, generates thrusts and, you know, yeah, loses itself in the woods.
I see it.
Or whatever.
I see equations right on the screenshot there. So probably, yeah, it's teaching you like how to design a model rocket, how much it should weigh and how much thrust you get or whatever.
Yeah. I have to say that, like I always thought when I was a relevant age child, I thought, you know, model rockets were pretty cool, but most of my interaction with model rocketry was in fact, like buying a little plastic model of something like a Cylon Raider or whatever that you could put together with glue, you know, putting it on the driveway, getting a camera, getting a model rocket engine, taking out the powder. But anyway, yeah. It had some pretty nice movies though, you know. Yes, anyway. I had a few of these. One of these is one that I did not have. This flight one I didn't have, but I had the physics one, and there were a couple of others as well too.
But you're saying these have mostly been imaged, like they're available and preserved?
I think that's true. I don't know about the flight one, and one of the ones that isn't one of these two that I had. I attempted to image it, but it turned out that it was one of these where I think the backside was blank for some reason, you know, so I think the quality control on these was not great, you know, because I think, and then another one I think was mastered off center. It was one of those ones where, like, you know, on the applesauce, you can actually see what the problem was, and it's, you know, like, it's a circle, but it's doesn't match the actual ring in the middle. So I'm mildly interested by these, but maybe not quite enough. Actually, it is currently at $34 and has two bids and has like 6 days left. So it's it may go up, and hopefully whoever does get it will archive them if they are not yet archived. Let's see. Did I have another thing? Oh yeah, this actually relates to something that came up earlier.
Oh, I mean, yeah. I like these.
Yeah, I think of these as kind of like, this is a Griffin iMate, you know, it's a ADB to USB adapter. I think this might be specifically for, well, it's got a picture of a mouse on it, so I guess, you know, it's for that kind of thing. Maybe it would work for a keyboard.
And you can tell from the coloring that it's from the iMac era, right. Sort of that translucent green plastic.
Bondi blue.
Right.
Yeah. Bondi blue, that was it, yes.
And I think of these as kind of like, cheap little, throwaway transitional things. But they're actually super useful. And if you don't already have them, bad luck for you, because this one's...
Oh, it's $100.
Exactly.
Is that typical of what they go for now?
I don't know, but I think they're actually kind of hard to find, so it might not be crazy.
Oh yeah, just did a quick Google search or quick eBay search. Couple for 100, one for 170, one for 280. Here's one for just 70 out of packaging. Holy moly, they've gone up.
And I mean, they were like $25 items, back when they were new.
Yeah, these were like garbage that would be at the checkout aisle at Best Buy or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this would actually be really useful if you wanted to use like an ADB joystick in an emulator, for example, on your modern Mac. Like, this would be a way to plug it in. It would be super useful.
Yeah. So I am glad that I have the ones that I do have, and I am not going to get rid of them, I guess, anytime soon.
Yeah.
Because you cannot replace them.
I used to have one, and now I don't, and I probably shouldn't have got rid of it. Oh, well.
I'm not sure. So it's, I think they may actually do different things. This may work for a keyboard and a mouse, but not for, other ADB things. And there's also serial ones. That was the connection that I was thinking of, like Quinn.
Yeah, the one I had was just a serial one is the one that I was.
Yeah, I still have one of those. I use it if I need to plug in, like, my Apple IIc's serial port to log something off of it or whatever. Yeah. That's the thing I was talking about, where you need the FTDI driver for it to work weirdly.
And I think that was is there not also, like, I thought there was some set of things, and it might have been those that actually suffered from, like, fakes,
being hard. There were fake ones, and also you had to know what chip was inside it, and that's still the case. If you buy a USB to serial adapter, there's two different major chips that they come in. The FTDI ones, and there's another one, and there's often no way to tell from looking at the listing on Amazon or whatever which chip is inside it, and you have to install the correct driver, and one of them works with retro stuff and one of them doesn't. The FTDI one does work and the other one does not. I think maybe like video standards, like one of them doesn't fully or correctly implement RS-232 quite or whatever, so it just doesn't work with a lot of retro computers that use old serial ports, so that's something to watch for.
Doing a quick eBay search on those, it's funny, there's so many available for like $2 to $5, but the ones that will say FTDI in them are like $30, $40, because they know their market, and like, you don't want to risk buying five of these things. Pay me $30 and I promise this one's good. Yeah. Oh, man.
By the way, O1Craft, I think I know who that is, but in the chat mentioned the Wombat, which is, of course, like another solution to this same problem, which actually costs less. It is a modern made USB ADB converter that is made by Big Muscle Wires. I don't know if it's still viable, but it should be again if it isn't right now. It looks like it is. Yeah
That's only $50. Big Muscle Wires is great. They make all kinds of awesome stuff.
Yes.
I love somewhere their floppy disk emulator, floppy emu, so good.
Yeah. I do have a Wombat somewhere around here. There's a nice case for it that you can get as well. This guy, the black acrylic case. So
nice.
Anyway, so if you don't want to spend all that money on the iMate, you can get a modern one that actually.
Oh yeah, it looks like the Wombat is currently available. Yeah,
for and your it mind. Actually goes both directions too. So
that's cool.
If you wanted to use a USB keyboard on your Mac, you can do that. If you want to use a Mac keyboard on your M1 Mini, you could.
That's really clever, actually.
Yeah. Let's see, did I have anything else? Oh, yeah. Last thing I had is somebody found somewhere a 5150 that has basically not been used.
Wow.
So
it's still got the shipping cardboard and the floppy drives. Wow. Yeah. Look at that.
Yeah. So it looks really nice. Until you look at the box. The box does not look very nice.
Oof.
It is covered in mold.
Ooh.
Oh, goodness.
And says, basement storage.
Wow.
But the machine inside.
Yeah, the box gave its life to protect that computer because the computer looks mint.
Yeah.
And the box, looking at the photos, the box is kind of moldy and beat up, but doesn't really look like it was immersed in water. I don't see the staining from that. That's what I'd be really worried about.
It looks like it's been shipped. Like there's some shipping company stickers on it, which is a little unnerving. But again, the computer looks flawless, but I wonder how much it's been banged around based on the condition of that box and the Flying Tigers Priority Service shipping stickers on it.
Anyway, it is. If you were looking for one of these things, I mean, they're asking $1,000. They have a make offer, and in fact, actually, I think somewhere in the description, this one says, you know, if you don't like my price, you know, then make me an offer.
It's being sold by Earl.
But no, don't like to buy at cost, then make me an offer.
I mean,
boxes mold all over it.
Yikes.
But the computer is clean as it was covered in plastic.
But no pictures of it working. So who knows if it survived that box or not?
It's, you know, if you are a museum and you don't care about the box, but do want something that likely was not used by anybody. I always wonder about stuff like this. Like, you know, like the 5150 was early enough that who bought one and then decided, I guess I don't really need this.
Yeah, that's weird, eh? I always think it's got to be someone who worked at a computer store or whatever and had a bunch of leftover inventory or something. Like, it's hard to imagine people buying stuff like this and then just never opening it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or someone bought it, you buy a house and it was sitting in the basement or something because the previous owner owned a computer store or something.
Right.
But it could be somebody who was, like, super anal about keeping everything and they've just put the little shipping things back in the floppy drives and they kept that box and those in their basement where it got all moldy and crappy, but the computer was used.
Yeah,
and
they just that's a fair point. I mean, for many years, I actually saved those little cardboard things. I don't think I ever used one, but I did actually save them because I was OCD that way. So yeah, we don't know that this hasn't been used. It's true.
Yeah. I think though we do, it is very much not dinged up.
Yeah.
I mean, so at least it looks nice.
It does look really nice. There's no marks on it or any sign that there's ever been a monitor sitting on it or anything like that.
And I sort of feel like when I look at, you know, the pictures at the back, like the ones I've got up here, I'm used to seeing them like full of rust, you know, this is very much not rusted out. So for what that's worth, I used to know how to tell. There were a couple of like revisions of the 5150 and I lose track of how you tell which one is which, but you know, like is this the you know, either good or not good, you know, oldest kind, depending on what counts as good.
So the chat is saying this has definitely been used because if it was original and untouched, the cards would all be black. So these are newer cards that's been put into an early model of the 5150 because they're silver and the machine is black. If I understand that chat message correctly. So that's a good tip. So this definitely has been used. Well, and there's a screw missing from what might be the serial port there or video port there. So it's been used. It was just had an OCD owner, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Or, you know, it's had cards put into it, at least. We don't know if they actually tested it. Yeah. But
someone was very careful with it. I mean, it's also like they could be low res photos too, so there might be smudges on it that we can't see because they kind of get blurred out by the photo and auto white balance and whatever else.
Yeah, I think if you were somehow dependent on this never having been used, it may be too big of a risk. And it's pricey, but it does it looks nice. So
I mean, for $1,000, I think that needs to be still sealed and like in a good condition box, not mold and clearly opened and probably used. But neat though.
Okay, that is all I had. So I guess we can move now to the closing discussions. Carrington, any closing notes?
I don't think so. I don't think I have any vintage related closing discussions. I've existed in a vintage free vacuum for the last couple of weeks, unfortunately. Boo, making bad choices. the Carrie Davidson story.
Yeah, honestly, I also don't feel like I have much closing thoughts to say. You know, we're almost caught up. Prior to recording today, we were almost caught up on the RCR feed, and then we knocked us back.
We ruined it by recording.
But I don't know. It's we'll get there. We'll catch up. I haven't done a whole lot recently. That's, you know, I've been spending a fair amount of time editing videos from the Kansas Fest that passed just recently. So pretty soon those videos will be up and available. Robert Woodhead gave the keynote, and it was really good, actually. And I did not know before that he was like the hacker consultant on Real Genius.
Oh, so that's cool.
So he's got a credit in the movie, and apparently, and I guess they were playing wizardry and stuff, like Laszlo or whatever was at some point playing wizardry on screen or something like that. Also, he wrote Virex. I did not know that, but the antivirus, you know, Mac program was apparently also written by the person who wrote wizardry.
Okay, are those videos going to be available online somewhere at some point?
Yeah, they should be. I'm hoping quite soon. I actually just sort of finished up the keynote, which was a little bit complex because I had, you know, like much compositing to do. But I now know how to use Premiere Pro.
Excellent.
So
yeah, I wasn't even able to attend the virtual KFest this year because it was landed right in the middle of my big move, and there was just no way I could even get online to watch the videos. Otherwise, I would have. So great to be able to watch it after the fact.
Yeah. I'd recommend watching the videos of the people in our chat and also the keynote. But that's about it for my notes. Quinn, any closing notes?
No. As I said last time we recorded, I will be hopefully soon getting my retro computer set up in the office that is behind me here. I'm starting to get the pieces together for that, but I have not been able to actually do that for real yet, so soon I will hopefully have retro computers behind me.
Excellent. All right, then I guess that is it for this show. You can find the notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com, which, by the way, we are trying to move to a new host. Any minute now. No, it's funny. I actually did, you know, like I spun up a WordPress instance, and I put it on a URL that, you know, like I wasn't using, or like a name that I wasn't using. Nobody knew about it. Still, in come the spam bots. I don't know how they how did they find me.
Incredible! It is incredible how they do.
You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
Retro Compute!